Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 17, delivered on March 22, 2016. The title of this lecture is Investment Decision Making.
Today, investment decision making. Before I begin, I'm going to run up to it with a little bit more about the previous chapter on stock, which has a way of folding into this topic. And I start with a subject that is a little bit far afield. Seems like it doesn't have anything to do with investment decision making specifically, but it does. Now, when I say investment decision making, what I'm talking about is the internal decisions a company makes on whether or not to accept a project. Yes or no is the what it boils down to. Yes, we're going to take on this project. No, we're not going to take on this project. There are real old ways that it was used to be done, long ago repudiated, but I've seen them in recent years still being practiced by some companies. So there you go. They're still out there, and I will cover those briefly or mention one or two briefly, and then get down to the brass tacks of how it's done in more ordinary traditional companies these days. But before I do that, I want to bring up a little bit more about stock in general. Now, the first part of this will seem like it's not related to the topic of this week's lecture, but then the next subject kind of connects to it, and that is even more closely related. Let me explain. Okay, now, you remember there was this standard model. Let me turn on the light here on this. Remember there was this standard model for pricing a security, a share of stock. If the stock has a stable dividend that grows at the same rate for the foreseeable future, we can write that the current price of the stock is the dividend one period out over the discount rate for that stock's dividends minus the growth rate of the dividends. Now, again here, recall that the D1, and I really can't see that. I wonder if the light turning light off would help. Yeah, it does. That the D1 is equal to D0, the dividend now, grown one period. That's just how the formula works. You use the dividend one period out. So we can price a share of stock by finding out what its dividend one period out is divided by the discount rate minus the growth rate. Now, if the stock does not have a stable dividend, but it does have a dividend, I mean, theoretically, you could say that the price of the stock is the dividend that is now in place plus the dividend one period out, discounted one period at the discount rate. Let me zoom in on this a little bit here. Plus the dividend two periods out, discounted back two periods, plus the dividend three periods out, discounted back three periods, etc., out for infinity. Now, that's obviously almost too complicated to use, because how can you predict the dividend if it's not stable? It's up and down and all over the place. How can you predict that dividend? But there you go. There's a way, at least theoretically, you could price a stock that had an unstable growth in the dividend, one way or the other. Now, I'm going to take this formula, the standard formula, I'm going to turn it around just for a minute here. And this is hinting at something that comes in a little, I think, next week or the week after that. If I were to multiply, we've got the formula P sub 0 equals D1 over the quantity K sub S minus G. Now, if I were to cross multiply and then add the G to both sides, I could rewrite this formula as K sub S equals D1 over P0, that fraction, all that plus G, the growth rate. Rewriting the formula this way, what I'm showing you is the cost of equity capital. This is the cost of your existing shareholders, and they are costly. All of your sources of capital have a cost. Your debt has a cost, the interest you pay, the after-tax interest rate you pay on it. Your equity has a cost, and here it is. Now, practically speaking, your after-tax cost of debt might be 6%, 5%, 4%, something like that in a typical corporation. Your cost of equity, if you do the calculation, which you will do for a maybe for a company or two, you'll find that runs 20, 25% sometimes, 16, 20, 25, 30%. The cost of equity capital is ridiculously high in a normal corporation compared to the cost of debt. So if you want to raise money, selling, rather, your shareholders are going to be quite expensive to you, and it gets even worse. If you need to raise new equity capital, you have to modify this formula. Look, that price of the stock, notice, the higher the price you maintain on the stock, the smaller this D1 over P0 will be. G is still going to be beating on you. But keeping the price high on your stock makes this go down. Your cost of capital tends to stay lower. If your price of your stock falls, your cost of equity capital goes up because the P0 is the denominator. Now, let's say that P0 is $40 a share. Your existing shareholders have stock that is $40 a share. So now we're going to need new shareholders. We're going to sell more stock. If you're able to sell it at $40 a share, you aren't going to get $40. P0 is no longer what you use in the formula. For new shareholders, I'll write here. This is the cost of existing shareholders. Cost of, I wrote that backwards, existing shareholders. If you sell new stock, yes, you might sell it at that same $40 a share that the existing shareholders have, but you're going to pay a flotation cost to the investment bankers. Or whoever is selling that stock for you is going to take a pound out of that price. We usually express the flotation cost initially as a percent, 10%. 10%. So that would be, for a $40 stock, that would be minus $4. You don't get $40, you get $36 after the lawyers, the accountants, the investment bankers, the Series 7 sellers of the stock get their money. You don't get the P0. What you get for new shareholders, from new shareholders, is P0 minus the float plus G. Then the minus F here would be in dollar terms. But like I said, it's usually expressed right off the bat as a percentage. Notice now that the cost of new shareholders is even worse than the cost of your existing shareholders. Because you'll be dividing D1 by a smaller number. That means the K sub S will be a bigger number. Selling stock to raise capital is expensive. Your existing shareholders are expensive enough, but your new shareholders are going to be even more expensive to you. You, madam, are an extraordinarily wealthy woman. You have a husband. He costs you. He's expensive to me. He's a high maintenance boy. You know, you buy him that BMW and, you know, a few other toys and stuff like that. Maybe one of those hovercraft that he can play in the backyard of the estate that you have. So he's expensive. But now you have to wine and dine this side, this cougar bait right here. No, dude, you're still getting your damn BMW, so quit your bitching, you know? He's going to be even more expensive to you because you've got to bring him in, reel in that young man-tart. You follow what I'm saying? Hey, you've got love in stereo, sort of. Not high definition, neither of them is. Okay, but it's kind of a silly way to show it, but to point it out, but those new shareholders are going to cost you even more than the existing do. And that's one of those problems that we have. We talk about stock as a means of raising capital is a bitch as a financing mechanism. Why in God's name would companies do that? And from your perspective, why would you, as an investor, be that stupid? Okay? Because you know that if they are selling stock, they are going to be taking on a cost of capital that is way in excess of what it would be if they had borrowed the money. So you've got a Facebook that does a multi-billion-dollar stock offering. On the other hand, you have a Netflix that goes out and borrows more than $1 billion on notes and bonds. Two very different companies. One is just taking on extraordinary cost of capital. The other one is saying, FTS, we're not going to do that. We're just going to borrow the money. Yeah, it's expensive, but it's not sure as hell not as expensive as taking on these shareholders. The only difference is that you can abuse your shareholders. You can't abuse your debt holders, of course. You can't ignore them. But here's the thing. First problem. Why would you ever invest in a security that is representing ownership in a company that's willing to take on ridiculously expensive, permanent obligation to shareholders? Now let me take you to the second issue. You, sir, are an executive at Megacorp International. Now, the stock price goes up and down. It's been down to 18, been up to 40. Okay, now let's go to your decision, right, that is on tap. Of starting a public offering. Now, when you want to sell new stock to raise money, you could either sell the stock at a point where you know the stock is, or at least you have good evidence that the stock is near its low, 18. Or you could sell the stock in this public offering at a point where the stock price is very high. Near its peak at 40. Which are you going to do?
When it's high.
Absolutely. So when you buy stock, think about the logic of the company selling it. Are they going to sell stock when the stock is at its low point and it's going to go up for you as the investor? Or are they going to sell the stock when their judgment is that it is at a high point and it's going to go down after the sale? Which are they going to do? Well, they're probably going to sell it. Now, if you are smart, you're going to say, no, you are doing an offering of stock, a public offering, when your price of your stock is at its high. You, on the other hand, are Mr. Stupid Investor. Oh, boy, I'm getting in on this stock when it's at its peak. Yep, I'll buy that and ride that son of a bitch down to the ground. You see the second problem with buying stock in an offering, a public offering. You are very likely going to be buying stock when the company has a judgment that the stock is near a high. Go.
What's the benefit of having this actually hitting people who do share because they're more expensive, so what's the logic behind that?
Getting shareholders?
Well,
that takes us to the next one, and now I'll use you, okay? You have an extraordinarily successful company. It's doing quite well. It can go to any bank. Its credit is great, and you can get the money, borrow money, or there are investment bankers who will be willing to write a bond offering for you to borrow money or notes, whatever, okay? You got a great company. Okay, now, he has a company that is actually listed on thiscompanysucks.com. It's in serious trouble. It can't, if it went to bankers for loans, they would laugh their asses off at it. Now, which one of you is going to be more likely to want to share your wonderful company with other owners? Are you going to share your company with other owners? Oh, hell no! Are you going to share your company with people who have a lot of money to be part of your company? Oh, hell yes. You see these investment gurus. I am going to share my investment success with you. Why? Because I am just a fine, upstanding stud. I am going to tell you all of my secrets that have made me a fortune. Do you believe that? If he really was that successful, would he really give one rat's ass about you? No. Why would he share?
Well, because people share. We've seen Barney. Sharing is caring.
Not in the business world. Seriously, noob. Okay. You understand that the messages that are being sent by companies selling stock are not good messages. Unless their cost of capital, of debt capital, has gotten too high for the bankers to talk about that, to talk to them, they're going to be very much more likely to seek debt securities to fund projects. You understand? That's all he's got. You ever been so hungry you went to payday loans? I have. You know, I'll sit there, I'll call them, you robber baron, you son of a bitch, but they'll sign that paper and take that money because I want my ramen noodles and Spam. Uh-huh, yeah. That's the problem, and I don't want to turn you off to stock, to investing in stocks. But I also want to forewarn you that the signals, the messages, the logic in stock sales and purchases tends to be biased to the downside, on the negative side. Watch yourself when you do it. One side of my family comes from the Pennsylvania Dutch. When I would go to visit them and spend time there with them, summers, when I left, the old man, old guy, he'd come out and he'd watch me leaving and he'd say, "You be careful out there. The world is full of Englishmen." And that's the message I give to you. You be careful out there. The world is full of people selling you stock. Matter of fact, I brought one of them in. I didn't bring him in. There was an Illinois State Students in Finance meeting last night. There was a guy in there, he was recruiting people to become salesmen for stock and investments. And he did not really talk so much about the investors. What he was talking about was the success of the salespeople, which means that he wanted them to be successful. And then as a side note, oh yeah, we have to talk about appropriateness of investment and, you know, good investments and all that, but the whole point was to sell the product. And then to convince them that you've done them a favor afterwards. So they'll bring you more of their assets. How much are we talking about, by the way? He said in your first year, they would want you to be pulling in committed assets from clients, new clients, $500,000 a month. And in your second year and your third year, more. Just getting people to pledge that you can handle their money, their assets. And that means, for one thing, you keep this in mind too, that you are not going to, as a salesman of stock, you are not going to be working for the working poor, low middle class, or even the middle class. You are going to be working for the one percenters. The rest of the world to you can go straight to hell because they don't have any money for you to invest. Now, let me take you to the second subject that brings us closer to today's main topic. This article appeared 2 days ago on Yahoo Finance, which you got to watch it because those articles can be written by all kinds of ignorance. But this one was actually good in what it was talking about, and I've known about this problem. Now, the writer was clearly a little off on a few things, and he or she stated a few ideas incorrectly, but the basic idea was this. Look, and I've been preaching this since the beginning of this course. I've been preaching this since I started teaching many years ago. Financial statements are prepared in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles consistently applied. And the audit of those by independent auditors so that they can be put in financial reports to the SEC for investors to read are surveyed. Are these in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles consistently applied? That's the way it's done. Now, you've all had an accounting course or two here. You know what I mean by GAAP, G-A-A-P, the Generally Accepted Accounting Principles. You've learned some of the basic ones and all of that. And you've heard me, at the very least, you've heard me bitch my head off that those financial statements don't reflect the financial state of a company. Okay. Well, this has been getting worse and worse over the years. GAAP is so deeply complex, so interpretable, that financial statements that are presented in the K's and Q's, those audited financial statements, they are so far afield from what a company's true financial state is that you can't believe them. You really can't, unless you are highly trained and can see behind what they're saying and figure out what the hell they really meant or what's really going on. And even I can be blindsided by a company. Those financial statements, I don't buy them to begin with, but when I look at them, I'm always asking myself, what is that number really? And what numbers are they not showing here, and all this, and what number over here in the balance sheet really is part of the income statement in realistic terms. Okay? So, enter a fad. It was almost like a fad. But you see, SEC tells you what you must do. But it doesn't tell you that you can't do other things as well. Okay? So, a lot of companies started producing a set of non-GAAP financial statements to go along with the GAAP statements. And these non-GAAP statements look quite a bit different from the GAAP statements. In fact, we have almost, it's sort of a hilarious little term. We call it the GAAP gap. Between the GAAP statements and the non-GAAP statements. Well, companies are almost, almost all companies are preparing a set of non-GAAP financial statements to go along with the GAAP financial statements. okay? And we know for a fact that a lot of those big investment gurus, those houses, those fund managers, they are looking at the non-GAAP statements, not at the GAAP anymore. They're looking at the non-GAAP. Some of them are even just not even bothering to pass by the GAAP statements. They're just looking at the non-GAAP. Well, that's a problem. Because there are no rules with the GAAP, not with the non-GAAP statements, and there are companies that are just lying like mofos on those. They are just putting up numbers that are just completely ludicrous, ridiculous. We do know that the companies that we've caught lying or really going creative on their non-GAAP statements are underperformers on their stock. We figure that out. And we sell off those companies. But at the same time, the non-GAAP statements aren't a solution, because if you are an unethical company, you're going to say whatever you want on those to make your profit look good on those statements, on those financial statements. Those non-GAAP financial statements. So we're in this bad situation where the GAAP statements don't represent the reality. And the non-GAAP statements give the preparers an incentive to misrepresent the actual situation. So where does that leave us? Let's take, before I answer that, let me take you to another piece of this puzzle. Rule 151A. Were you by any chance told about this rule in your accounting class? Didn't think so. You might have heard the term. Have you ever heard the term mark to market? Okay, mark to market is a rule 151A is essentially, and this is a very simplistic way of explaining it, but rule 151A said after all those scandals and all that bull crap on financial statements, even GAAP financial statements back in the 90s and the early 2000s, Rule 151A said companies must put on their financial statements the market value of certain assets and certain liabilities. Not the book value, the market value. So you might have spent in your company $10 a share for 100,000 shares for a position in another company. Okay, book value on financial statements would be $1 million. Okay? $10 a share for you would have paid $1 million. And that's what would have been on the GAAP financial statements in the old days. Rule 151A said no more. You must put on your book, on your financial statements, what that 100,000 shares times the current price. So if the price had fallen to $6 a share after you bought your position, then on your books would be no $1 million. It would be $600,000. Now, that seems like a very reasonable rule. So we would have book, which really never meant that much anyway, or market. And one rule 151A simply said mark to market for your financial statements. That should be a better representation of your financial situation, of the reality of the value of your company. Sort of actually making the accounting statements more like reality. Well, after the 2008 crisis, Rule 151A was suspended. Rule 151A was suspended. And companies no longer have to mark to market. You see, because after that massive crash, all of the stock and all of these securities that companies held of other companies, those companies' financial statements would have been big goose eggs in a lot of cases. So they suspended Rule 151A, saying, well, if they mark them to market, these companies are going to look like they're dead that invested in other companies, that have securities of other companies and all that kind of stuff. You got the idea there? So that's why Rule 151A was suspended. But the suspension has never been taken off. No marking to market. Now, still. And the question is, when will they allow marking to market to occur again? I can't tell you when. But as it stands now, marking to market is not part of the protocol in the GAAP financial statements. And most companies that are preparing non-GAAP statements, if marking to market makes the company's assets look like they suck, they ain't going to mark to market. They're going to use the book value. You see? So they are free on the non-GAAP statements to mark to market. But they would only mark to market only if it made them look better. So that's a bad situation there. However, let me emphasize one thing here. It sounds like I'm saying book bad, market good. Sounds like it, doesn't it? Book bad, market good. Market good. Okay. Well, let me help you clarify that just a little bit. I'm going to walk up to you, sir. Just out of nowhere, I walk up to you. One morning, you're walking across campus. You're feeling the breeze in your hair. You're feeling pretty good about yourself. You read some Marvel comics last night, and you're figuring you could be a superhero. All that stuff. And I just walk by you. Now, I'm getting to be kind of an old professor. And I've got my cane. Yeah. $6 million. Yeah. And I just walk away. You think, well, that was random. The next day you're walking across campus and then you see me again. And $6.4 million. Yeah. I walk away. And you're thinking, you know, like, should I call, you know, old man services and have them cart him off? He seems harmless enough. Well, a few days later, you're walking across campus and I see $5.3 million. I walk away. You know, and you're wondering, what in the world is going on? And then another day, a Thursday, $5.9 million, yeah. Now, by this point in the conversation, you are asking the deeply philosophical question, take that out of your view so you can't do a cell phone capture of it. Teacher said something bad, wrote something bad. Well, Friday comes. You're really excited about life and all that. Oh, God, here that guy comes. And I look at you. $2.1 million. And I walk away. Now you're really confused, but something kind of strikes you. You had seen the news this morning. The market had been highly volatile, generally tending downward through the week, and then it crashed on Friday morning. What I was doing was marking your ass to market every day. What the present value of your future expected cash flows were. That's value, right? A market would assess value and mark to market any asset, and you, sir, have an you are an asset, aren't you? You're selling yourself to companies. When you get your job here, you're selling yourself as an asset, and I marked you to market every day. And when the market crashed, I marked your asset to market. Okay. Now, sir, is their value really changing that much from day to day? Absolutely not. You were the same person Friday that you were on Monday. As a matter of fact, you probably improved because you had two of my classes, so you're obviously worth more now. I mean, you went to see a couple of movies. You watched a movie on Netflix. That enhanced you, clearly. You listened to a couple of One Direction songs, and that, you know, marked you down a little bit, but... Do you understand? Marking to market is not the Holy Grail, because the market moves up and down and up and down. It was like they asked one of the Walton people who had a massive amount of Walmart stock, "Sir, you lost $1 billion today," or something like that. And he looked at the reporter and he said, "It was paper then, it's paper now." You see, marking to market doesn't tell you the truth. We don't have the truth. Go. Yeah, that's basically marking to market is better than book, but it's not Holy Grail. It's not truth. If you want truth, read a philosophy textbook or get yourself drunk and do some math theorems, okay? Seriously. Truth is not something that we have. We have evidence. Evidence can lean toward one conclusion or another. It can be compelling toward one conclusion or another. But it is not truth, because a fact is not a truth. A number is not a truth, ever. Keep that in mind. That's probably the only place you're going to ever hear this. Scientists are going to tell you they've got the truth. Preachers, priests, and imams, and rabbis are going to tell you they've got the truth. In our world, we don't need the truth. We just need evidence that gives us something to hold on to and to cover our asses. And that's where we get to our next topic, the topic of the day. But you understand why I brought this up is because at this point, now we have to get into the world of deciding whether or not a project is a go. Yes or no is what we're going to do on these projects. Our decision criterion is that simple. But again, it's not the truth. Many projects have been accepted that turned out to suck. Many projects have been rejected that probably would have been a good idea. A great example of this, some years back, it scares me when I'm telling you stories from the 1990s and you weren't freaking born yet. That really troubles me deeply. But a story from the later 1990s, I think it was. There was a lot of competition with search engines. There one that was quite popular at the time was called Excite. And there were a couple of other search engines. There were other search engines too, and they were all kind of vying for position, bumping up against each other. And there were a couple of really cool things called meta search engines. They would actually search other search engines and then bring back the best results from all of them. The search engines were also a lot better than they are now because they weren't all paid whores. Google is, you pay Google, it'll put you top. You don't pay Google, you're going to be out there in the far reaches of the universe. And if you don't want something to be said about your company, you will buy top hit on the first five pages and you'll set up hundreds of websites that look like they're not yours and have them pay top dollar to Google to promote you as well. But it was a lot different back then. A big popular search engine was Excite. Well, there was this little search engine company. It was just floppy. And it just couldn't get a groove going. Had a stupid-ass name. And they offered to sell their search engine to Excite for $1 million. Well, Excite just completely ignored them. No. $1 million? No. So they came back and said, all right, $500,000. Excite said, no. Well, that little search engine that was trying to get sell itself to someone was called Google. $500,000 for Google. God. Excite, I don't think Excite is even exists anymore. So sometimes we can reject projects that we should have accepted, and we can accept projects that we should have rejected. Great examples of that. McDonald's.
took on a project. They accepted a project where they would start selling pizzas at McDonald's, family size and personal pan size pizzas. Did you know that? They were in the pizza business. Well, they refitted all their restaurants with pizza ovens and all that great stuff. Had a problem. First problem at the drive-thru. You order a pizza, they have to make it. So you had to have people pulling forward. They didn't wait to plan for that. That was a disaster. Well, they started, all right, we'll prepare the pizzas in advance. Okay, well, that's cool. Family-sized pizza. Pull up to the drive-thru window, order your family-sized pizza. Turned out that none of the drive-thru windows could get a pizza through them. I swear to God, they were actually, I was at one. I ordered they were delicious. Don't get me wrong, these were actually darn good pizzas. This guy said, hey, yeah. He chopped it and he folded it. Dude, I don't want this thing now. You know, this is a pizza, this is a calzone. You know, I didn't order that. Projects you accept that you should not have accepted. You know, but if you've got a numerical base, then you've got a standard accepted procedure. That's your ass coverage. Cover your ass. I did it by a standard procedure taught in every major business school in the United States and Europe. You got your butt covered even if things go south on you. So now, what I want to do here is I'm going to take you over. Bear with me one moment here. And I'm going to take you over to the financial calculator. We are going to, well, hate this. Okay, let me get the Pearson financial calculator up. I mean, you can do these on your own if you want, but I would recommend you don't. Really? There. Okay, let me sign in here. And I'll show you how to, I'll walk you through this with some examples. Now, I imagine that if you were in an accounting class, they would have you do this with tables in the back of the book. And I've heard stories that they're still using the tables in the back of the book for present value kind of stuff. And that tables in the back of the book, yeah, I did them in my time, and I used math, hand math and slide rules. These financial calculators, of all the things I hate about modern technology, these are one of the things that is very nice, and I'll show you how to do it. But let me explain the basics of it. What we are trying to accomplish is making the future expected cash inflows from a project comparable to what it's going to cost us to do the project now. So in other words, we're going to say the revenue stream from this project is, and here at the time now is the cost of the project. So we're going to telescope back in time all of those future expected cash flows and put them to the present and compare it to the cost presently. If the present value of the future expected cash inflows is better than the present value, the present cost of this project, we say yes. If the present value of those future expected cash flows is less than the cost of the project now, we say no. It's that simple. Yes, no. That's the investment decision-making criteria. But let me show you something kind of a little off the wall here. How it used to be done. Now, if I had not been a consultant and I had just gone to college and learned the standard ways, I would have said, whoever used this? Thank God that's not been used in decades. Well, when I was a consultant, I ran to companies that still did project evaluation. Investment decision making, an old, really bad way.
Let me show you. Suppose that I had a project that was going to run $5,000 now. Cash flow zero. CF zero. Now, let's do cash flow one, cash flow two, cash flow three, cash flow four, and let's do cash flow five. Okay, the project kicks off with a $1,250. Then it goes in first year, then it gets its legs under it, $2,500. And then it pulls another $2,000 in year three. And then it pulls another $1,000 in year four. And it pulls $500 in its last year of life. This old bad method I'm showing you is called payback method. It starts with a simple rule that the company has, and I'll tell you one that these aren't the exact same numbers at all, but the president of the company said, well, our payback period is 3 years. Literally, I didn't understand what he was talking about at first, and then it hit me, my God. He's telling me that they don't take on any projects where it takes more than 3 years to pay back the initial investment. So in this case, they would have accepted the project. You see it? Because it paid itself back in 3 years or less. They would reject any project that paid back the investment in more than 3 years. Bad first level, they're not taking into account the present value of those future expected cash flows. They're treating those as if they are exactly equivalent to the current cash flow, the current cash outflow. The other bad thing about this is that it would create a bias in a company toward quick pay projects. In other words, a project that took several years just to get its market together, but after maybe 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, it would begin to pick up speed and strength, product recognition, brand loyalty, and all that would take longer. That project could be a winner for years and years. They would reject it because it didn't pay off the initial investment in 3 years. So this payback method is deeply flawed because it really strongly biases for fast payoff projects. The other thing about it is just where do you get the 3 years from? You pull that out of your ass. I mean, you're just taking a guess. Unfortunately, there are some modern methods that are acceptable to a certain extent where you do that too, and that's a sad thing, but there you go. Now, let me take you to the a project, and I'll do costing. Oh, let's do $5,000 now. We'll return $1,000 in 1 year $2,500 let me do $1,500 in year two. $2,000 in year three, and $500 in year four, at the end of which the project will end with a salvage value of $900. Now, caution for you here. Most of the problems in the book will have a salvage value of zero. In real life, most projects, at the end of them, you can sell off at least some of the equipment, sell off the intellectual property to a bottom feeder or something like that. I know in my own company, in evaluating a project that was to buy a new printer, a very high-end expensive printer, a $2,000 printer, I figured out how much I was going to make each year off it, off that incremental asset. And then I figured at the end, okay, I'll be able to sell this. As long as it's not busted, shot to hell, I'll be able to sell it off to some amateur photographer or something like that who'd really love to have it but couldn't really afford a lot. It has a lot of life used on it, but it still has some life in it. And I'd probably have some ink cartridges and paper to give them. So I figured, okay, at the end of the life of this, I'll probably be able to unload it quickly for about $300-$400. So that in real life, there is a salvage value. Great story down in the basement of the College of Business, and by no means is this atypical. You'll see this, I've seen this in so many colleges. There's a part of the basement here that you have never gone into. It's a dark place. It's an evil place. It has all of these old computers and monitors in it, just lying around. And they are old technology. They are worthless. But at the time they were taken out and replaced with a newer technology, those things could have been sold. So whether or not you choose to throw it away or stick it in a basement, you have an opportunity cost whenever you lay off equipment or technology. So the fact that those things are down there, well, we never made the salvage value off them, is irrelevant. You could have, and that is what you should be putting in your numbers, is the opportunity cost of not selling those old computers off when they still have value. Now, they have no value now. I mean, it's way too late for that. But they did at that time. I mean, a 486DX... at the time they let that thing go, there were nerds galore who would have bought that. You could have even donated those to schools as tax write-off. There's schools that don't have a lot of money that would have died for rooms full of those computers. But they're still down there. Okay, anyway, enough of that ranting. Always make sure that you think about, is there any salvage value at the end of the life of a project? And what is that salvage value? Okay, now, here's what I got. I'm going to just draw you a nice little timeline here. Now, here's C0, the now. The C1, the C2, the C3, the C4. Is that four? Yeah. Okay, now, right now, we have out the door 5,000. Then inbound, we'll have 1,000, what did I say, 1,500. Then we'll have 2,000. And then we'll have a debt drop-off, a hard drop-off. Salvage value, you just add that to the last year's cash flow. Just add it to the last year's cash flow. Don't forget to do it, but that's where you put it. So the last year, you actually pull in $1,400. That should give you the incentive to get that damn old equipment on some kind of list for sale. Because that's a decent little punch at the end of the project here. Now, our job is to pull back all of these cash flows to the present. And these are positives. And add them up and then subtract 5,000. If you get a positive number, the project is a go. If you get a negative number, the project is a no. That's all there is to it. Yes, no. There's no nuance to it. There's no if, and, or but. It is yes or no. It's a simple decision criterion used widely. Now, in order to discount cash flows, of course, you're going to need a discount rate, right? And you're also going to need those cash flows out there where I is greater than or equal to 1. You damn well better know your C0. That's not a guess. That's not an estimate. You should know how much it costs. You come to me and you say, well, we're really not sure of the cost. I'll just say, go away. You come back when you've got the cost. Get me 3 bids, find the lowest, and we're good. Try to be like that. I had a nice incident. One of the great business fraternity had a charity volleyball game coming up. And I was talking with them. They were really bubbly and all that. It just annoys me. And I said, okay, do you need sponsors? And the one young man said, well, we're always looking. I said, stop. Say yes or no. Do I need sponsors or do I not? He couldn't bring himself to say yes or no. The girl standing next to him said, yes. Good. Yes or no. Always give specifics. Give specifics. Okay, now, the problem is that we don't know the case of S with the C sub I. The thing is, though, that the case of S, I will teach you in just a couple of weeks, the capital asset pricing model, we'll have the case of S. For now, I'm going to pull one out of my ass. The C sub I's, estimating the future expected cash flows, you got to be objective. The problem is that there are differing incentives in the company. Projects can often be launched by marketing. They will be analyzed by MQM, then to the finance people. They might have numbers produced by the accounting people, but marketing would be involved. Now, who's a marketing major in here? Okay. Now, if you're giving me a project, madam, you're giving me the cash flows. Are you going to tend to underestimate or overestimate how great your idea is? You're going to overestimate. You're going to have every incentive to overestimate. You are too. That doesn't mean I'm going to look at your numbers and say, you lying son of a bitch. I'll think that, but I won't say it to you. I can tell you a wonderful story about this. I might have told you. Did I tell you the story when the mayor of Bloomington spoke to my classes about the new Coliseum? Okay, I didn't. I was teaching in another school in this area, and it's a private college. And we had the mayor of Bloomington at the time, she was the mayor, and her dream, her legacy, was to build a Coliseum for all of these incredible entertainment events. Oh, it was just magnificent. She wanted to speak to all of the business students at this private college. And so brought in my finance students, trotted them in, the management students, the marketing students, they all trotted in. They were all dressed perfect, preppy, and all of that. The way they dress to pretend that they're better than you. And then they go home and screw and drink and take drugs like bandits. I won't mention the name of the school. It was Illinois Wesleyan. Did you see that one? But there she came. She brought her finance planning guy, her city planning guy, along with her. She had him on a leash. She was a scrawny little weasel of a guy. Come on, sit, boy. And she told all about this dream of hers. And then she said, all right, speak. So she had her little finance guy explain all of the estimates for the costs and all the estimates for the revenues of it. And Well, it started off badly because he showed the cost and I raised my hand. I said, well, where's the cost of the land? Oh, we already own the land. You already own the land. So that's no opportunity cost, is it? Well, spank me, Jesus. You don't need to consider opportunity cost, the cost of the best foregone alternative. You don't need to consider that land as cost because you already own it, right? He knew darn well. His face turned red, but he kept going. God love him. And he went to the revenue side, talking about this revenue that this Colosseum was going to generate. He said, all right, here we are at the Colosseum. Here is Bloomington Normal. Who the hell am I kidding? Here is Bloomington Normal. And he said, we have a 60-mile radius of potential buyers of tickets to this Colosseum. Okay. So we have 100,000 households in that radius. And they will buy, each of them, 2-3 tickets a year to events at that Colosseum. Right? So you see how he was building mathematically cash flow projections? First of all, what is within in the 60-mile radius of the Coliseum here in Bloomington? The Peoria Civic Center. Old, famous. Second of all of those people who live in the countryside, that's 60 miles. I don't know if you've noticed it. You drive out here, you know what you see mostly? Cows and corn and beans. You don't see a lot of sophisticated urbanites who go to concerts. What you see are prairie hillbillies. You don't see people who go to the high-minded events where they talk, and now we're going to play a selection of Schubert. No, you have white cracker boys driving big trucks playing rap that they have no idea what the lyrics are. They go thumpa thumpa mofo, thumpa thumpa ho ho, thumpa thumpa bitch, and talk about how they've suffered as much as urban people have. They're going to go to those Coliseum events? No. Ma and Pa Kettle, you know what their idea of a big evening is? Chicken. So you gotta watch yourself when you do this, these projections. Don't live in a fantasy world. Okay, we've gotten that out of my system now. So let's go through and let's crank on the how you do this on your calculator. Really, it's so easy. You gotta watch though. Watch me screw it up. I always do once or twice when I'm pushing these numbers in. But watch what you do. Now, the first thing you always do is hit your reset button. Okay, don't ever forget to do that. Okay, now, what we're going to do, let's put, by the way, on that project, let's put a case of S of 10% on the project, okay? So we'll discount the cash flows back at 10%. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, hit the cash flow button, CF. Notice how the calculator's screen changes. It's getting ready for decision making, investment decision making. So the first thing it's saying is, what's your cash flow zero? How much is going out the door? And in that case, that was $5,000, hit positive negative. And then you hit enter. And notice how the 5,000 has shown up there as a negative. Now you hit the down arrow and it immediately takes you to cash flow 1. Which in our case, what was cash flow 1? $1,000. $1,000. Enter. Now watch what happens when you put the drop arrow here. It says, oh, how many years does that happen in a row? That's frequency. So in other words, if you have one of these projects that's got like 5 years of the same thing, you don't have to pound in $1,000. You can just say, okay, for 5 years, it's going to have a level. That's not actually not that abnormal for a projection to have a flat period in your cash flows. Okay, you've entered that. I can't remember whether I hit enter. Okay, now go down. Okay, what's your second cash flow? Yeah, thank you. 1,500. Enter. Now, go down. It'll say, okay, how many times does that happen? See, it's always going to give you a chance to do the frequency before you move on. And you say, okay, I always hit the enter, and I'm never sure whether I need to or not, but I always hit enter. Now let's go down. Okay, what's cash flow 3? That was 2,000. Enter. Go down. How many times does that occur? Once. Okay, enter. Go down. Okay, cash flow 4. Now, this was the one that was the composite of revenue and salvage. So that was, what was it? 1,400. Thank you. 1,400. Enter. And go down. Enter. Now we need to give it the discount rate. The I over Y, which I will say is 10%. Enter. Enter. Really? Seriously? I over Y. There. I say hit the I over Y the wrong way there. I always do that. Okay, now we're ready. Compute the net present value. My ass. The frick did I do wrong there? Damn it. I knew I was going to screw something up there. Let's try that again. Reset. Cash flow. Okay, 5,000. Negative. Enter. Down. 1,000. Was it 1,000? 1,000. Enter. Down. Enter. What was the next one? 1,500. Enter. Down, enter, down, C3 with 1,000, 2,000, 2,000, enter, down, 1, enter, and then the last one was 1,400, 1,400, enter, down, enter. Now, I over Y, 10, I over Y, enter, compute, it's negative net present value project. We just say no, that's it, no. Let's talk about, and I'll finish this up in the next lecture, but what happens if we had decided to use a 5% discount rate? 5. I over Y, enter, compute the net present value. It would have been positive. So in other words, there was an interest, a discount rate somewhere between 5 and 10% that was the crossing point from positive to negative net present value. In the next lecture, I will introduce you to the internal rate of return. That's that interest rate. Thank you.